Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hi, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Laura Rance. Much of Canada's domestic flour milling capacity is situated in Ontario, but most of the wheat they process comes from Western Canada. The volume of hard red wheat processors can buy from within the province has been declining over time. In fact, only 7% of the Ontario wheat supply comes from hard red milling varieties. Farmers who continue to grow wheat at all have shifted their acres to soft red wheats. Ontario milling companies want to buy more wheat locally, but it's turning out to be a tough sell to farmers. John Gregg is editor of Farmtario. He's here to tell us why. Hi, John. Welcome to Between the Rows.
Thanks, Laura.
Now, it seems like a no-brainer. You have a local buyer for Ontario hard wheat. Why aren't there more sellers?
Well, there's really two reasons. The first of all, the agronomics of hard red wheat and the ability to get the protein premium for hard red wheat is challenging in Ontario. And with the advent of much easier to grow and rewarding, I guess you'd say, soft red varieties, that they kind of have kicked most of the hard red wheats out of the growers' rotation. Then the other factor is that if you want to convince a farmer to grow more of a crop, you need to find a way to pay them more to make it make sense financially for them, and that just hasn't been the case reliably in Ontario for several years.
So what makes Ontario such a tough place to get that high protein?
Well, our climate, really, it tends to be a damper, warmer climate, and it just isn't a spot that the protein reaches the hard red protein levels that they can get in Western Canada. A lot of farmers have experimented with adding that nitrogen at very specific times in the hard red wheat growing stage, and the response just isn't reliable enough for them to know that they're going to get it. So when you have a few years of expecting you're going to get a certain reliability, and you think you've done all the management steps that you need to get to a certain protein level, and then it doesn't happen for over several years, it becomes a bit discouraging. Discourages farmers from growing that crop.
So if they don't get that higher protein, they end up with a lower quality wheat, which presumably is worth less than they would expect to get with the soft reds?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So why are the millers worried about this, or why are they concerned?
Well, they really would like a local supply for several reasons. First of all, just because a local supply from nearby is easier to manage, I think. And then the whole focus on local has become an increasingly important to their marketing, to their customers. So when they're finding from consumers and retailers back to the millers that they're requesting local wheat and they don't have it to show or to sell, then that's a lost market opportunity.
So what are they hoping to do about this?
Well, I think it's still a bit in the early stages. I don't see everything this turning around in the next next year or anything. But I think there's quite a bit of discussion now. We've become very good in over many years in Ontario growing identity preserved soybeans in here. And the thought is, well, we should be able to grow identity preserved wheat as well. Part of one of the other factors is in all of this is that it became easier for elevator systems to just handle one type of wheat. So if they just get soft red wheat, it just makes their life easier. So there has to be a premium through the system in order to encourage the growing and the handling of more hard red wheat. So I think there are several reasons why that's not happening yet. A lot of our wheat tends to be pooled. So if you have a variety that you're trying to identity preserve, there's going to have to be infrastructure created, and it's going to be worth it for the system to preserve that particular variety. So there's a lot of talk about it now, but I think it's going to be a little while working its way through. But I think that is probably the long-term future is identity preserved wheats, most likely hybrids or groups of hybrids, that have certain management criteria attached to them that will hopefully drive the product that the millers want, you know, through the system, and also some profitability back to the farmers and the, you know, the people on the ground that sell the wheat seed to farmers, and also often that are involved in contracting it, have said to the millers, you have to come up with a premium that is, or just a rate that is going to attract farmers, and then you have to be repeatable with that, because part of the concern with a crop that has marginal acres is that buyers often are in and out of that crop depending on the year and depending on the supply from elsewhere. So if you want a dedicated supply from this region or the province, you're going to have to commit to buying, you know, every year, so that system can be created to drive the product through.
So it's going to be a combination of price incentives, but also a long-term commitment to the local supply.
Yes, and I think also some improvement in the in hard red varieties. Now, people who do that sort of work tell me that there has been significant improvement in hard red varieties over the last 10 years. So some of that work has been done, and I think that word has to get back to farmers.
Well, thanks for telling us about this, John. John Gregg is editor of Farmtario. This is Between the Rows. I'm your host, Laura Rance. We've been hearing a lot lately about protein, and plant protein in particular. Nearly all of the fast food chains now are following A&W's lead in producing plant-based burgers. Canada's iconic meat processor, Maple Leaf Foods, has just announced plans to spend $310 million building the largest plant in North America for plant-based protein. Bratwurst made from peas, anyone? So what does all this mean for farmers in Manitoba, a province that has already invested in livestock production? The Manitoba government recently launched a discussion paper on protein strategy that pays homage to both sides of the protein equation. The Manitoba Cooperator's Alexis Stockford has been following the story. She's joining me now to talk about what that might mean for the province's farmers. I just wanted to start by asking about this coming on the heels of Canada's newly revised food guide. Did that factor into what the province is thinking about protein policy?
Yeah, you know, I think that's actually a pretty common question that a lot of people listening to this podcast will actually have a similar question. And when I asked Agriculture Minister Ralph Eichler about that, he basically said that, you know, the food guide, they're basically seeing it as a guide, but they're not taking that word as gospel, so to speak. And he was very adamant that he's very supportive of the livestock industry, and he's not moving necessarily on that particular opinion or that particular policy direction.
So what is driving this initiative?
Well, I think the drivers for the initiative are just, you know, the provinces wanting to jump up a little bit on this increased demand for protein, or this perceived increased demand for protein from the consumer point of view. And they're trying to increase Manitoba's business profile in those protein businesses and that protein sector, both plant-based and animal-based.
So what does the government hope is going to emerge from the process that it's just launched?
I think that is still very much up in the air, and I think that's a very important thing to consider is, even though, like, they've basically announced the protein strategy, but they've announced consultations for the protein strategy. So what they're doing right now is they're talking to producer groups, they're talking to businesses, they're talking to just producers themselves and looking for public feedback on what this protein strategy could actually look like and what the nuts and bolts of it are going to be. And so a lot of those details are still very much up in the air. They've actually, just very recently, they announced that there's going to be what they call a protein summit that's going to be held in Winnipeg I believe the date is September 16th. And they're hoping that that's going to very much further some of those discussions and help inform where their policy goes from there.
That's right. Like, this is really a discussion paper that they've posted online. But have they?
Yes, exactly.
Have they talked at all about what kind of investment they're hoping to attract towards this?
Yeah, well, there are, like, the discussion paper or the consultation paper that they released in February does have a couple of numbers, things that, like, kind of general goals that they're saying that they're going to want to see realized by 2025. So things like, for example, they're hoping to see 1 billion of new plant protein processing investment attracted into the province, resulting in 850 new jobs. And likewise, on the animal side of things, they're hoping to see 500 million in new primary production and processing investment on the animal side. And they have some numbers, like, for example, they're hoping to see a 35% increase in animal protein production by 2025 compared to 2017, and a similar increase in processing capacity. But within those numbers, in terms of how that's going to be spread across the sector, whether that's going to be pork, whether that's going to be beef, whether that's going to be soy, whether that's going to be pea protein, like we're seeing with roquette, which is expected to come into Portage la Prairie in the near future, all those details are still very much up in the air.
There's been a tremendous amount of interest in the plant-based side of this, and you mentioned roquette, and there's several other processing enterprises starting up across the prairies. But what's holding this sector back at this point in time?
See, that is a very interesting aspect of this whole protein strategy and this whole protein discussion. Because if you look at where it is right now they're still keeping everything very, very broad strokes, very general. And so the topic is very, very huge. Because when you just look at protein, there's a lot of sectors, a lot of businesses that can go underneath that name. So one of the interesting things is in terms of how much support the plant-based versus the animal-based is actually going to get underneath this strategy. Because like the consultation paper says, the province is being very careful to say that this is both plant and animal based. But at the same time, when you talk to the province and when you talk to places like the Food Development Center, the plant based market does require a lot more development than the animal based protein market does, because, you know, animal based protein is something that's kind of established in the province, as opposed to plant based, which is really kind of only starting. And so they are saying that that underneath the strategy, there is going to have to be a little bit more focus on the plant based side of things, and in development and in research and that sort of thing, to help that aspect of the protein sector catch up, essentially.
Alexis, what are the producer groups saying about this?
Well, they're obviously very excited that this is a thing that the province is looking to explore. They have noted a couple of challenges that they're hoping, I'm sure, are hoping to address. And when you're talking to the beef producers, for example, they are bringing up a lot of the things that they're in conversation with the province about in terms of challenges in building their herd size and that sort of thing. One of them being, this whole Crown Lands review and the review of how unit transfers and that sort of thing are going to be looking like in the future. And they're basically saying that things like that need to be resolved if they're going to grow their herd size to the size that'll support that protein growth that the province is wanting. And then people like the pulse and soybean growers, they are basically pointing to a lack of resources in the research department. And they're basically saying that there's going to have to be some collaboration with, researchers from Saskatchewan and places where some of these protein markets and protein research is a little bit more established, in order to develop things like peas and lentils and that sort of thing.
So if farmers or the general public have some thoughts around this, is there a way for them to contribute to the discussion?
The different commodity groups are definitely in discussion with the province, and they've been in discussion with the province until like the end of this month. They also, though, are looking for basically public feedback, and any farmer or any member of the public can can submit that feedback. They're looking for written submissions deadline, written submissions before May 15th, and they basically say that anyone who's wanting to do that can do that by email. I think it's mbproteinadvantage@gov.mb.ca, or they can mail their written submission to Manitoba Agriculture.
Well, thanks for joining us, Alexis. I think we'll be following this story as these different ideas emerge.
Thank you very much.
Alexis Stockford writes for the Manitoba Cooperator. This is Between the Rows. I'm Laura Rance. Well, we're still on the protein trail, but this time we're talking about meat and how you know what you're buying at the store will cook up when you get it home. How do you decide what to buy when you're looking at those cuts at the meat counter? What does A, AA, or Prime labels really tell you? A team of students at the University of Edmonton is proposing a different system for helping consumers figure all that out. They believe it might encourage people to buy local beef more often. Jeremy Sims of the Western Producer recently wrote about their idea. He's here now to tell us about it. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Now, we have a grading system for beef that is periodically updated and revised. Why do these students feel it's not working for consumers?
I think they think it's not working for consumers because consumers don't really necessarily know how to cook beef. So when they buy an A, a double A, a prime, they might not know how to cook that certain cut, and then it doesn't taste so good, and then they associate it with it being bad, perhaps, to that prime A, double A, no matter how you kind of cut the grade that way. And so they get put off by it, and they might not want to buy beef again because it didn't taste good. And that's not because producers are doing a bad job and they're not raising their animals properly. It's because consumers don't know how to cook it, and therefore they just get a bad taste in their mouth and want to choose elsewhere.
So what would this proposed system change about that?
So this proposed system would be a 5-star model. So you're rating beef from 1 to 5, and essentially it is a guarantee to consumers that if you buy a 5-star beef and you cook it to the directions on the package, you're going to get 5-star beef. Same with 3 stars, 1 stars, whatever. And so, yeah, it just gives them that guarantee. And then perhaps, say they buy 5 stars, it tastes like 5 stars, they're going to come back and buy more 5 stars and then potentially increase more local sales.
So is that 5-star or 1-star rating related to how you have to cook it, or is it actually related to the quality of the meat that they're buying?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So it would be related to, I guess, the quality as well, but you'd have to combine the two. So there would be quality beef would be rated higher, and that would be determined just through the cut of the animal and then how it was processed and just all of those standards. And then you would have to follow these cooking instructions to ensure that it does meet that quality that it actually has.
So if you wanted something to throw on the barbecue, you would be looking for a certain star ranking versus something you were going to put in a stew pot.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure.
So how did they come up with this idea?
So they came up with this idea at school as part of their capstone project. It's like the big last 4-year project before they graduate. And they approached their professor, Heather Bruce, and I think there were some conversations happening, and they obviously saw that maybe the current grading system isn't working as well as it could. And I think Heather Bruce as well had some ideas, and so they came up with this 5-star rating because, yeah, it has been actually used in the past.
And so it's being used in some other countries, as I understand it.
Yeah, so it's being used in Australia. They've had it for some time, and it's a really interesting story there because they revamped, like, most of their grading because consumers, their purchasing of beef was slowing down. They weren't buying as much, and they didn't like the taste of the beef as much. So they did a whole consultation thing, taste panels where people were trying beef and creating this algorithm to determine, you know, this is 5 stars, this is 4 stars, et cetera. And so once they created this new model, producers got on board, packers got on board, retailers got on board, and these sales have kind of gone up a bit and more of it is being bought because they have this guarantee there. So they're thinking, well, Canadian beef is already really good. Why don't we just make it even better and have this model here?
So is there any indication that retailers might be interested in adopting this?
I haven't heard any indication yet that retailers are willing. This is super preliminary. Obviously, it's a student project, but I wouldn't be surprised if a retailer or two would. You're already seeing this movement, verified beef, that sort of deal. So that wouldn't surprise me. What the students have been doing is they've gone out and talked to the Beef Grading Agency and the BCRC. Again, super preliminary, but at least they're getting this idea out there. We'll see what happens in the future. And if it does even go all the way up to some government proposal, I'm sure we will hear a lot more of it in the future.
Well, thanks, Jeremy.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Jeremy Sims of The Western Producer. After what seems to have been a never-ending winter, spring has finally sprung in Canada. For farmers across the country, it means seeding will soon be underway. In fact, in some areas, it has already started. Bruce Burnett, Director of Weather and Market Information for Glacier Farm Media, is joining me now to talk about what's on farmers' minds, I guess, as they head to the fields this spring. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
So what are the concerns that farmers are thinking about as they start to plant this year's crop?
Well, I think certainly after the long winter, everyone was concerned about getting out in the fields and getting onto the land in a timely manner. But we've really seen a good melt here during late March and into April. The conditions are actually been quite good because we've reduced the flooding risk in some areas. As well, we've managed to get some farmers in southern Alberta and southwestern Saskatchewan into the fields now and starting to plant. The temperatures haven't been all that good. There have been some lows down into the -5 to -10 range still in the middle of April, which isn't ideal for getting crops germinated. But certainly we're off to a better start than in some other parts of North America, at least anyway.
And so, yeah, you've mentioned that there still is a risk of some flooding, but that's been reduced. But what about soil moisture conditions overall on the prairies? Are they looking pretty good?
Actually, for southern and central areas of the prairies, they're quite dry.
Okay.
We've had 2 years of drought, essentially, across those areas, and we've used up a lot of the subsoil moisture there. So that combined with a relatively dry winter, and certainly the months of March and early April have been quite dry. The topsoil moisture has dried out significantly, especially in, again, the southern and central areas. Up in the northern regions, there was more snow this year. Last growing season, they had more rainfall. So the moisture conditions in the northern growing areas still is quite good. And in some areas that did pick up that extra bit of snow this winter, they're actually still waiting to get onto the fields because it's too wet.
Now, I guess if you had to compare to some of the visuals we're seeing out of the American Midwest these days, having a little bit too much dry on the Canadian prairies isn't such a bad thing. I mean, what's happening south of us and how's that going to affect farmers there?
Yeah, certainly what happened in Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota into Minnesota, their spring wheat areas saw a lot of winter precipitation, mostly in the form of snow, but also some rain here recently. And that caused the flooding issues on the Red River flowing north into Manitoba, but it's also delayed their progress. So for the middle of April here, we're only seeing about 2% of the crop in the ground all so far, and most of that's actually in the Pacific Northwest, not in Montana or North Dakota or Minnesota. So there's a lot of work to be done there. My biggest concern on planting spring wheat in the U.S. is actually in South Dakota, because of course they had that big snowstorm a week ago, and they have virtually none of their wheat in the ground, and they would usually like to have that planted by now.
And it doesn't look much better for the corn farmers either, does it?
No, we're seeing some very persistent rainfall patterns in the Corn Belt. We had that large snowstorm that moved through the western parts of the Corn Belt as well as some of the spring wheat areas. So certainly that moisture has built up. They had a very wet fall as well, especially in Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, northern Illinois. Those areas certainly have some saturated moisture conditions, and that's going to take a long time before farmers can get in the fields there.
And they seem to be getting storm after storm. I mean, is this a storm track that sort of stuck over that region or that path?
Yes, if you look back, and again, back to the wintertime, the storm track has been relatively consistent here, and it's basically been south of the prairies, which is why we've been dry, and it's essentially from about South Dakota across into Chicago area, where we've seen the bulk of the precipitation fall, not only in the winter, but also in the spring here. So that's certainly cause for concern in that we've seen the stuck pattern for about the last 3 months, essentially.
And is that something, I mean, are we stuck in a dry pattern then too?
We are certainly stuck in a dry pattern right now. We would hope as we move into the spring, further into the spring, that we'll see the rainfall start to move northward here. That is the typical pattern, although the storm track is rather consistent right now. It does tend to wobble during the spring as we get sort of warm spells and cold spells. We get a lot more activity in the prairies on the moisture side. So we're hoping that that happens. Certainly, I think for farmers, the best scenario would be for us to remain dry until planting is over and then start to see those rains arrive in May and June.
Is there any indication of what's causing that stuck path or those storm tracks to hang around?
There's really no precise one factor that's causing it. Some people have tried to link it to climate change, and I think there's some credible arguments there that some of the patterns that we're seeing with stuck, essentially moisture flows, is partially due to some of the changing patterns that we're seeing globally. So it's something to keep an eye on here. Again, not to dismiss that too much, because over the past, this is how we get droughts and things like this, is we get stuck in a pattern. So it has happened in the past, but certainly seems to be quite a bit more frequent right now here in the early 2010 to 2020 period.
Well, thanks for joining us, Bruce. That's all we have for you this week on Between the Rows. But thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week. I'm Laura Rance.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to etr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.